Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the last podcaster, Duncan Nichol.
And this week, Duncan, we are reading something which I believe both of us have wanted to sink our teeth into for a long time. I know for a fact that in the very first list of books we put together for this podcast, two and a half or so years ago now, I think.
Oh, getting on to that.
You put on that list The Last Unicorn.
Yes, that's right, Geordie, by Peter S. Beagle, one of the seminal works of American fantasy literature, and one that we couldn't have actually done for a few years. There was a point this was off the market. There's some rights issues, it was all off, you know, taken down from Kindle. You could not buy a new copy. Thankfully, that got resolved probably a year and a half to 2 years ago now, so you can all rush out and get this book.
Is it as recent as that?
Yes.
I thought it was more like 2015.
No, I'm pretty confident this was going on till like at least 2020, which I realise isn't 2 years ago, but please don't remind me of that fact.
The reason why I think it was 2015 is that I discovered The Last Unicorn in like matters that related to the rights issues, because I'm a big fan, Duncan, of a band called Ninja Sex Party. Are you familiar with them?
No. What a name, though.
Well, they make great, quite silly songs like No Reason Boner, Dinosaur Laser Fight, Attitude City, but they also occasionally do covers, and one of the covers they did was of The Last Unicorn, because they did it in honor of Peter S. Beagle around the time that he was finally getting the rights back.
Oh, well, then fantastic. I hope it was that long ago and he's had the rights for much longer. But Geordie, more than the question whether or not you can buy this book, should you buy this book?
Ooh, very good. Very nice framing, Duncan. But before we get stuck in, and I have a lot I'd like to say about The Last Unicorn. Spoiler alert. Yes, you should buy this book. It's beautiful. Have you been reading anything else in the meantime?
No. I'm just an illiterate savage. I've recently started a new job, Geordie, and I've had no spare time. To be fair, I have read lots of books. They've just been textbooks and not worth talking about. So,
are they interesting textbooks?
Not if you think Six Sigma processes and the basics of C coding is interesting, which it actually is, but no. So other than playing a little bit of Legend of Zelda, which I have actually gotten quite into at the moment, I finally picked up Tears of the Kingdom.
Oh, great. Because you were thinking about buying Breath of the Wild last time I spoke to you. This was a couple of months ago, after Tears of the Kingdom had come out.
Yes, I know. Oh, I had this moment. I'll tell the full anecdote. So, and it can get cut out in the edit when it's dull. I was leaving my old job and my manager, my last one-to-one, was just sat there and just went, looked at me and went, "So Duncan, I've always had you down as the Legend of Zelda man." Like, out of nowhere, this question comes. And I'm like, okay, I see where this is going. Sit back. Yes, you'll be right. I would love the Zelda. I haven't played any of the new ones on the Switch. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Hope you understand. And for my leaving present, I got Tears of the Kingdom.
Oh, so awesome. That was lovely. That's so great.
I know. And I had to, like, I went to lunch afterwards and had a guy be like, "Didn't you want Breath of the Wild?" I'm like, I'm not complaining. Like, just, it's fine.
For my money, you got the better game.
Well, exactly. And apparently I heard the reason why I got Tears of the Kingdom is that, like, it was the new one. And my manager just went into shop and went, "What is the best Zelda you sell?" And they were like, "This one." He went, "That will be it then."
They were right.
So I'm really enjoying it. I don't know if this will, like, impact my enjoyment of Breath of the Wild, but I've not experienced this sort of open kind of fantasy game. Like, I played Skyrim. Half an hour of The Witcher 3. It didn't grab me. It was too complex. Like, Zelda to me has just this right balance of, like, there's enough depth and things to do that I get kind of thrown myself into it. But at the same time, all the mechanics are very intuitive and very in the world. I don't know how to explain, but it's like, I felt like when I was playing games sometimes like Skyrim or The Witcher 3, like, I spend a lot of time in menus.
Yes, especially like, The Witcher 3.
I need
3.
To do that.
Like, making potions and like sorting out your powers. Very dull. Not interested. I also have failed several times to play The Witcher 3. The Legend of Zelda,
I'm sure it's a great game.
The only menu that you actually have to navigate is what weapon that's going to break soon am I going to navigate to, and which of these like six powers can I use in the situation, and normally only a couple of them are actually relevant and you can use them in cool, interesting ways.
that's the thing. It's like simple toolkit, but really complex ways. And sorry, just touching on the potion making, I love the fact, and love it is like a little bit time consuming. I love the very in the world sense of the potion making. It's not like in Skyrim or The Witcher, where you go into a menu, just go up to a thing, and I feel like I'm now going menu. I like the fact you have to like hold the items in your character's hands and then press a button to drop them in a pot.
I know.
And then they bubble away and then you get the item. Oh, it's great design. Anyway, so that's not literature, but it is good fantasy. Geordie, what have you been reading?
All right, the question of whether or not it's literature is almost more of a philosophical one, but I have actually been reading a lot. So, Priory of the Orange Tree, Duncan. That's the episode we're supposed to be doing. We really probably should have flagged that up earlier. That was the plan for what we were supposed to read. We are not doing that episode today. Why is that?
Because neither of us have finished it.
Yeah. How far into it are you?
If I said a third, I would be grandizing slightly.
Okay, I think I'm about 60% of the way through. It's been about a month that I've been reading it, and I've been reading other stuff in the meantime, most because I really cannot bring myself to read Priory of the Orange Tree for any extended period of time. So, in the meantime, I have read Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. This is my first
ever... There is a name that I have heard.
Yeah. This is my first Tom Clancy novel. I've never read any of his before. I've only seen The Hunt for Red October, the movie. This is a very different book from anything I've read before, because I don't read military fiction, and I don't read extremely nerdy information about submarines. I now think I might know more about submarines than you, Duncan.
I doubt that, but go on.
A really cracking book. It's so in-depth on like a bunch of extremely niche, nerdy information about different planes and boats and missiles. I had to keep going to Google Image to be like, okay, what does this plane look like? Like, what is this Russian fighter jet that was made in the 80s that's very important to the logistics of this war that I need to understand? The characters are extremely like, I just need someone in this place and time. I don't care about giving them character depth. They have simple wants and needs, like being a good ship captain. The end of the book is really abrupt. It's like, we want, that's it. The war's over. That's it. Stop. And everyone gets like all the characters, and there are a lot of prospective characters. They get like a paragraph each to wrap up their story. And none of them get to, like, see their family again or, like, talk to their friends or anything. So it's fascinating. Very much enjoyed reading it, but not like anything I've read before.
I'm always fascinated by Tom Clancy. I would love to give some of his works a go. Because, to be honest with you, Jordy, I only know Tom Clancy's name because I get stuck on so many video games that I genuinely, at one point, didn't know if he was actually a real person.
Well, to be fair, a lot of the stuff that is written by Tom Clancy is not written by Tom Clancy. One fact, one of the people who actually wrote some of Tom Clancy's books is Steve Pachenik, a lunatic who often goes on Alex Jones's InfoWars and is actually responsible for the murder of an Italian prime minister.
I wasn't expecting to go down that type of rabbit hole.
No.
What? Wait.
Yeah.
No. First things first. Tom Clancy is an author, or is it a brand?
He was an author until the time of his death, but I think he basically got divorced, and part of the settlement of the divorce is you have to keep writing novels because your income is based on your ability to write novels, and so your wife needs to have a share in, like, one, the money that comes from novels, because that's part of the equity of the divorce. And two, she needs to have, like, a hand in making these novels because, you know, she gets control. She has, like, ownership of, like, the company, essentially, that makes them now. So at a certain point, Tom Clancy might have been writing these novels, but actually he was handing it over to, like, other people who were knowledgeable about spycraft and military technology and logistics information. Because Tom Clancy, a guy who's very interested in military law and technical jargon, but not a soldier. Wanted to be, couldn't do it because of, like, glasses or something. And, like, by the way, one of the main characters in this book is, like, a 5'6" Air Force guy who couldn't be a pilot because he has glasses, but he proves himself and becomes an honorary member of the Marines by the end of the story and gets the girl and kills 3 Russians with a knife.
Aw, I love a good self-insert.
Adorable.
Well, that is a story even more complex than Peter Spiegel's one. So, okay, maybe that needs... Did he ever write fantasy? Can we ever justify him on this podcast?
Certainly not. I mean, this book is basically fantasy because occasionally you would just get hit by a laser beam of conservative politics. So, in that way, it's even more fantastical than Peter Spiegel. However, I don't think I should get into everything else I've read. That's the only one I have a lot to say about. I also started rereading The Count of Monte Cristo. I've almost finished that book on the fall of the Nazi Party by William Schreier. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, that's it. Almost finished. Things are not looking good for Mussolini, Duncan. Anyway, Peter S. Beagle.
So, The Last Unicorn. Very simple premise. It is about the last unicorn, or so she is led to believe, although I don't think she actually ever believes it. We begin in a magical forest. The unicorn overhears these people chatting about how there are no more unicorns. She's like, that can't be true. I do not believe it. That's impossible. And she goes off on an adventure to find the other unicorns. Cue fantasy.
Yeah, this is like the questiest book we've ever read. It's about a magical creature who goes out to accomplish a goal. She meets a series of trials. She meets a series of friends to help her on those trials. And ultimately, she gets what she wants. But it's actually a far more... I was about to say complex. It's not complex. It's emotionally
nuanced.
Complex story. Much more so than you'd expect. It's nuanced, yes. It's a much more nuanced story than it would appear on the surface.
So, I think we've both made it clear we like this book. You should give it a go. I think I particularly like it, I said, because it has this very simplistic questing outline, but there's so much sort of, it takes sort of emotional turns, particularly in terms of what you'd expect. Because when you start reading it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is a kid's story. I've got it. But then it sort of gets a little bit self-referential. It's like, we know what the fairy tale is, and it plays with sort of the happy ending in ways that I was like, oh, I haven't actually read something like that in a book that felt like this before. It definitely put me in mind of some of my favourite of sort of young adult literature. Obviously, I'm reading, I'm thinking, yeah, The Hobbit, like The Hobbit, not Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. And a little bit maybe of Howl's Moving Castle was coming through from the
sure.
world.
It has that breezy, magical, whimsical air to it. I definitely see what you mean with that. It feels like sometimes it feels a bit like a Terry Pratchett novel without quite as much snark.
It has moments when it comes to, I think you're talking about like the kind of comedy, because it kind of plays, you know, a bit of parody on some of the fantasy tropes, very Terry Pratchett.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
There was never a biting edge that I think was like, oh, you're really trying to make me laugh. It's more like, we're going to play and recognise these tropes, but I'm not actually here to get you laughing out loud. At least that definitely didn't come across to me.
Yeah, it's not satire. It's not like it's actually pointing its finger and laughing at it. It's more like it's elbowing you in the cinema. You know, it's like saying, hey, how about this, you know?
But most of all, Geordie, before we kind of go through the characters and the plot events and the little mini episodes and quests that happen, I think this book is just really beautifully written.
That's so true.
There is paragraphs in this which I had to stop and reread. Not so because I was my eyes wandering, I got bored, what's happening? I just needed to kind of re-go over and like appreciate this visual metaphor that was being painted. There is almost a poetry to some of the descriptions in this book where we really do take small moments where the characters are, in effect, they're just walking down a corridor. But the sure. author expands this scene out to a page and a half of just beautiful writing. And I don't think it ever gets, because I think there would be a risk you could hear that thing, oh God, is that going to get tedious?
No.
I think it always lands on the right side of it, because what we're doing, it's not just describing the physical event in a very poetic way, but it's giving the moment to tell you what the characters are feeling as this mundane thing or you know, small moment is happening in a very poetic way.
Absolutely. I especially think of this one moment in the story where it's the series of events. It's about Prince Lear is visiting Molly in the kitchen to read the poetry that he's written. And then and just setting the scene there and talking about time passing, it's done in such a beautifully soft, gentle way. And then it follows up with this like brief confrontation on a stairway, which is so full of unstated emotion. And it's just done in a way in which Beagle describes these two characters standing there facing each other. It's gorgeously done.
I don't know if this is an apt metaphor, but I feel like if we've done, you know, Kings of the Wild and it's rock guitar, I don't know, you could see there's a bit of a minstrel on their lute when you're reading something like maybe more like House.
I would say it's a gentle oboe solo, if I can look to the famous song The Last Unicorn, which was made a part of the movie.
Well, not actually being familiar with that, I was going to throw in a harp at this point. But yes, it has a famous adaptation. Geordie, I've not seen it.
I haven't either, actually. I wanted to in advance of this episode. I've been a bit busy. I didn't get around to it. Maybe we'll do a bonus episode at some point.
I know it's, is it Rankin-Bass animation?
Is it? I think you're right, because I think it might be Rankin-Bass, because I've heard that, like, a bunch of the people who made The Last Unicorn went on to found Studio Ghibli. And I'm pretty sure that's true for Studio Ghibli. Like, it came from, like, people who used to work for Rankin-Bass.
It's, I'm sure, a much more complicated wibbly-wobbly timeline. But I know the animation style that I've seen clips from puts me in the same mind of the old animated Hobbit, which I have seen. And there was a film, oh God, what was it called? I think it was called Dragon's Flight?
You're right, it was... Yes, directed by Arthur Rankin and Jules Bass.
So definitely a Rankin-Bass production then.
Yes, it's a Rankin-Bass production. Speaking of the Hobbit movie, slightly parallel to that, did you know that Peter S. Beagle was the guy who wrote the screen... One of the two guys who wrote the screenplay that was used for the Bakshi version of Lord of the Rings?
Oh, what? The,
The animated one.
Yes, the... What's his name? Baskin? The chap who did it? I have also seen that.
Ralph Bakshi.
I did not... I had no idea Peter S. Beagle was involved.
Yeah, hopefully he wasn't the guy who didn't know how to write Saruman.
Oh, God, yeah. No, it's a really weird... It's an adaptation which... I don't think the script... So what they try and do, they try and get Two Towers and Fellowship into a single... 2-hour experience, and for me, to be honest,
right.
It's not the script that I think actually completely botches it. I think it's actually quite good. The animation in that film does not sit well with me. I don't know quite what it is.
Yeah,
I think I heard that they filmed live actors and traced over them, but there are definitely scenes where there are just live actors, and it's, I don't know, feels a bit icky, almost.
Yes, it's famously weird and sometimes unsettling, but it has its strong suits, and I think part of that is some actors' performances and the script itself. Like, there's a line, and I hope Peter S. Beagle wrote this, there's a line in the Ralph Bakshi version, which doesn't exist, I believe, in any other version of The Lord of the Rings, which is after Gandalf falls to the Balrog, and they're on the steps of Moria on the other side. Someone says, but there is no hope. And Aragorn says, then we must do without hope. There is always vengeance.
Oh, gosh. I love that. Do you know what? I was actually going to cut in and be like, my favourite bit about that version is how they do Aragorn. Like, that version of the character has just such an edge.
Okay. Right. What was I saying? Well, I'll say one more thing before we get to the book, which is that in addition to writing the screenplay for Lord of the Rings, the animated version, he also wrote the teleplay for one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek: The Next Generation, Sarek. A great episode.
Sadly, I can't speak to that one. That's not Tribbles, so haven't seen it.
That's Spock's dad gets dementia.
Oh, well, that's sad.
Yeah, it's sad. It is a sad episode, but it's also extremely touching.
Did he only write that one? Okay, or was he Right, yeah, back to The Last Unicorn.
I believe he only wrote that one, yes.
So, okay, let's kind of break it down. We said it's beautiful, it's wonderfully written, but it's also got filled with some really lovely characters, and I think these characters do an... well, Beagle does a main job of these characters by having them both being quite surface level and then hinting at an incredible level of depth. And I think the first one is obviously the unicorn herself.
Yeah, just called the unicorn. Well, until a certain point, I guess.
I think this is an excellent portrayal. Firstly, I love the physical description of the unicorn, not just being a horse with a horn. It's going to having sort of like deer legs, a more elongated neck, the eyes apparently are slightly more...
A lion's tail is mentioned, yeah.
So you're like, oh, this, it gives this more, this is a mythological animal. It's not as sort of earthly, but also I do, okay, so I come back to poetic language, love the description that like the beauty that people see when they look upon it is more so than what it just looks like. This is the embodiment of like goodness and hope, wholesomeness. I don't actually, maybe it's not actually that. It's at least beauty and I think a purity.
Yeah, it definitely goes to a very like Tolkien old fashioned idea that like that which is good is beautiful. She is so beautiful because she is so good. She represents like a better world. The world is worse and darker and crueler because there's only one unicorn left.
Which, to be fair, is interesting enough on its own. You know, I'm not necessarily, obviously, from a wider philosophical view, I'm like, well, that doesn't quite right. Not necessarily happy
sure,
with that.
I would agree with you there.
But for the fantasy setup and for the delivering of a story, I don't mind having very strong lines of this is good because that's what I'm telling you as the author. You know they're good, this is pure. But what I think is really interesting in that sort of goodness and purity is that the unicorn actually at quite a few points acts a bit aloof, tad arrogant.
Absolutely, because she's so good.
Yeah, she almost can't quite relate to the humans around her, which is obviously a key point.
And that, I think, is like one of the best motifs and themes throughout the book is the unicorn's highness and pureness is so great that, as you say, she can't really connect to the characters. She doesn't know what it's like to be human. She doesn't value humans properly. She's looking for the other unicorns, not because it's going to make the world a better place. She's looking for them because, you know, it's bad for the unicorns to be gone, her people, her species.
And that's kind of interesting, because it's not this sort of purity, this... I don't want to say self-centred. She's not being self-centred. She's trying to save her entire species. That's a very noble act. But it's not for this
wider good.
But
she is self-centred. She's convinced of her own beauty and importance. She's like, I'm the most beautiful being in the world. Quite matter-of-factly. And she might well be stating a fact.
Which then kind of makes it quite fun. But I also feel then that plays off against, particularly with character Molly, who we'll discuss a bit more later, the idea that she's so beautiful and she's earthy. It's like, yeah, but you don't have to struggle. Like, she's immortal as well. So, and this major factor later, you know, so she doesn't see how, like, well, you know, when she looks down at people, I often get like, yeah, well, they've got a lot going on. Appreciate their meager mortality and that they can't naturally just be good. So, but I like that, having that kind of ethereal, arrogant tone.
I think we should circle back to like the unicorn's arc in this story, because while she is like the central character, and at times she is like the main character, there are two characters I think really fulfill the role of protagonist. So let's start with, even though Schmendrick appears first, I think we should start with Molly, because I feel like we can talk about her without going too much into like the actual plot things that happen, but also because she's my favorite character in the book.
Oh, she's absolutely wonderful. Molly is, as far as I'm concerned, the every person. She's the most, I personally feel, open to be self-insert. If you feel that that's the unicorn, good for you. But Molly's different. She's had the hardest life. She has no magical destinies around her. She's not a wizard, magician of any type. she's just sort of, I don't know, appreciative.
A nondescriptly older woman.
Which is a really important detail. In fairness, actually, yes. I think the first big emotional gut punch is when Molly first sees the unicorn and she lets out this amazing lament. Oh, Joel, did you have that to hand?
I do indeed. It's a lengthy section, so I'll cut it down somewhat, but it begins with, "Where have you been?" she cried. "Damn you, where have you been?" Two steps forward, blah, 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 blah. "I am here now," she said at last, she being the unicorn. "And what good is it to me that you're here now? Where were you 20 years ago, 10 years ago? How dare you? How dare you come to me now when I am this?" With a flap of her hand, she summed herself up. Barren face, desert eyes, and yellowing heart. "I wish you had never come. Why did you come now?" The tears began to slide down the sides of her nose. The unicorn made no reply, and Schmendrick said, "She is the last. She is the last unicorn in the world." She would be, Molly sniffed. It would be the last unicorn in the world that would come to Molly Gru.
Okay, King Straight Doctor, just hearing that.
It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. Unicorns are supposed to come to maidens and princesses, and when she shows up to Molly, she's like, "Why now? Why when I can't be anything special? When I'm all done and withered up?"
I think it's I love the power of this man. I do think it's really great to see in the stories, firstly, older characters being given a bit more of the spotlight. And it's...
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
And this is what we're talking about when it like flies in the face of sort of fairy tale tropes, but not in that kind of snarky way. This is hugely emotionally impactful. Why aren't you following the fairy tale? Why didn't you come to me when I was a young girl? Oh, you know, whatever her old role was. And you were meant to lift me up at a young age and set me upon my magical adventure.
As dark and sorrowful as that opening passage was, it does end with her saying, "I forgive you." And actually... Molly's role throughout the story is the person who, like, cares for the unicorn the most. Like, she's her ardent defender, and she's always working for the unicorn's benefit.
She's the heart of the team. She's the one that pretty much everyone goes to talk to confide in, because it's actually incredibly hard to talk to the unicorn.
Yep. Unicorn's a bit above it all. Molly's got a good head on her shoulders. She's sensible. She's capable. You know, when she, like, takes over, like, as a servant at King Haggard's castle, there's, like, a humorous bit where they describe that, and she had to do, and these are all the jobs she had to do. I mean, it lists every possible job that could be done in the castle. And the funny thing about it is just that, like, yeah, well, Molly can do all those things. Like, you know, she's not superhuman, she's not a wizard, but she can get on and she can take care of stuff that needs to be taken care of. And her being there and her being inquisitive and kind and dependable is what helps her save the day in the end.
I think I really also enjoy, this is jumping quite a bit ahead, there's a bit with Molly near the end where, and I mean the very, we're talking the last three pages, where Molly and Smendrick are going to ride off into the sunset. And there is a description of Molly where, you know, it says, you know, she lets her hair down. And in that moment, you know, she was more beautiful than, I'm not going to say the unicorn, it's like, well, ever was. And you're like, you know.
Yeah, she's more beautiful than she'd ever appeared before.
I think that's a really nice statement. Not the sense that it's because Molly is physically kind of changed, but it's the fact that she's gone to the point where she is, I interpreted at least, saying, let her down, and, you know, she's finally had this release. He's, you know, she can fully embrace
she's
life and the adventure, and that's what's given her this look. You know, it wasn't about the age, it was the rut of life that she found herself in. And because we find her hanging out, you know, with brigands in the woods, is that where you wanted to be, Molly? Very much not.
The other main character to talk about is the character of Schmendrick. And Schmendrick is a very strange character, because it's so easy, I think, to get it wrong in describing him. So first things first, Schmendrick is a wizard, but he's not a very good wizard.
Schmendrick is simultaneously the young, not very good journeyman's wizard, and at the same time, the ancient, wise, all-powerful, all-knowledgeable, I know what needs to be done, man. And
that's yes,
but
exactly.
I think what this does really well for Smendrick, at least from, you know, going through it, is that it's never quite clear to me as a reader what there is when he's playing the part and when we're seeing a little bit of the true Smendrick. I think
exactly, because he speaks confidently about matters of magic and he seems to know a lot of things, but he also sometimes is just kind of an idiot.
Yeah, he messes up in this. There's lovely descriptions where he's the gleeman, to use a bit of time term, the travelman in towns, and he performs magic tricks, and he says how he drops his juggling balls and it was sort of good enough to get them the meal or what have you. But then later on he talks about the deep magic and has that insight about what the unicorn and what the story has to be and where they're going.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to get a pin on his character because I genuinely don't know, even having finished the book, other than the fact that Smendrick is genuinely nice and good-hearted, I would say so, what his actual
ultimately, yes,
motivations and like wants are. He sort of falls into the quest, what? And you're like, okay, you're here. How much do you care? Because it's not like Molly. Molly loves the unicorn. We know that. But with Smendrick, it's a little bit like, just coming along? Is it for you? Is it for her?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about it, which is that he falls in with Unicorn because they just happen to be in the same bad situation. And I think that it's just the sort of programming of it being a fairy tale. But I kind of assume that Smendrick was a good guy. I mean, he did try and free the unicorn after all. Like, he recognized that it was wrong to keep her in captivity, and he was brave in trying to do so. But ultimately, at a certain point, Molly says, like, you don't care about anything except magic. I kind of realize that that's true. Like, he freed the unicorn because she's magical. And he was interested in her, and he wanted to protect her for that reason. He didn't want to do it because she was, you know, a person who needs to be helped.
Yes, but then also no, because in that same statement, I read that when Smendrick replies, yes, I am only interested in that, you know, it's almost sardonic. I think he's... And later on when he says, I never really, you know, I didn't love you as much as them. I personally think you could read that as him being a little bit disingenuous and he's sort of hiding how soft he is.
Yes, I agree that it's... I definitely don't think it's sardonic, but I agree that it's like he's saying, yes, I don't care about anything but magic. And he's being dishonest. Like, he wants that to be the case. He wants to be this powerful, wise magician. And he feels like if he is only focused on magic, that's how he could accomplish it. You're right that he... And it's still true, I think, that he doesn't love Unicorn to the same extent as Molly and Lear. Lear definitely loves the Unicorn more than him. But nonetheless, Smendrick himself, like, the story that he follows is that he wants to become a better wizard. And he has the power to become a better wizard. But he only manages to accomplish that by, you know, not trying to be a better wizard. He does it by trying to do the right thing. And that's... It's not really a lesson that he, like, has to learn. Like, oh, of course, I should have known all along. It's just that it's like, it's the classic. The magic comes to him when he needs it. And he needs it not to save himself, but to save the unicorn. To save the unicorns.
Quite right. And one other kind of point on Smendrick is, because it obviously links deeply into the unicorn, which we haven't mentioned, he's immortal. Small plot point.
I keep forgetting that. I genuinely do.
It's never brought up in a physical sense. It's not like he ever gets stabbed and doesn't keel over. It's just that he, or at least I don't actually know if that was how it would work. Again, not presented. But he doesn't age. He was cursed by his wizarding teacher that he will never age until he's bloody decent at what he's up to. Which, I'm not going to lie, it's phrased as a curse. It is the greatest blessing you could ever have. You've got eternity to become good at this. Go along.
But like, once you're good at it, you'll fucking die. Oh, actually, no, that's pretty good. There's something poetic about that, being like, telling an artist, like, you will only die once you complete your greatest work. And at a certain point, the artist who lives for their work keeps creating, like, beautiful works of art, and they don't die, which means there must be something even better for them, which they haven't created yet. Well, that's a good story. I'm going to edit that out. I don't want other people getting my ideas.
And it's a great contrast to the unicorn. The unicorn, which we'll go on to in a minute, has their own brush up against mortality. So it's really fun to have a character who's chasing mortality. You know, they want to progress. They don't want their life to be stuck in this point. They can't move forward with their life and their career until they achieve this thing. And the fact that that means they're going to die, I don't think really bothers Smendrick at all. Because death will come to all. What it actually means is he can finally become the old wise wizard, which you can't do when you perpetually look 22.
Peter S. Beagle was 22 when he wrote this novel.
Oh, God.
Isn't that crazy? 22 years old.
That's really good. Sorry, I've just got a moment of perspective now. 22. Was this even his first work?
No, this was his second work, I think. He wrote something else before this.
That he pulled his heart into this, and I think what's really important, like looking at this book compared to a lot of maybe more modern literature that we've been reading, is that the focus is purely that's a lie. What makes this really stand out is the fact that it's kept the fundamentals as simple. The story is simple. It's not complicated. It's not politics. It's not morally grey. It's not an epic of 600 pages. It's just really well written.
I tell a lie. I think he started writing at 22. He wrote this when he was 29. So I still have time.
I have 4 whole months. Come on.
We've talked about the 3 most important characters. There are a couple more we can cover, but we can't talk about them without talking about the plot circumstances under which they appear. So the unicorn is searching for her people, the other unicorns. And at a certain point along their journey, they learn that the unicorns were chased away by the Red Bull. And the Red Bull is under the control of King Haggard.
So they take their quest to Haggard's kingdom. They visit the town of Haggate. Mm-hmm. And we discover some key details in this section. We learn that, firstly, there's a couple of curses going about. That son of Haggate will ultimately destroy them all. The castle, the king, and their town's prospects. And that the people of Haggate, in all their loveliness, decided no more babies to prevent this curse coming true. Just the people, by the way. This wasn't Haggard's idea. This is the people when we don't want our prospects going down. No babies. To the point of which, when a baby rocks up, they're like, let's just leave it in the freezing snow and that will take care of that. But this baby is rescued by the noble King Haggard. And he takes the baby and raises it as his son and prince and heir, Prince Lyr.
Lyr.
Lyr. L-I-R. I pronounced it Lyr the whole time.
Yeah, he wasn't Lyr from the planet Omicron 8. Yes, the curse is, as I remember it being, maybe you can correct me if I'm slightly wrong here, there's a couple of curses at play. The first one is that King Haggard is cursed to never be happy. Is that right?
I'm not sure if that actually is specifically a curse on him. I think he is never depressed. Happy, but I don't know if that was the curse. Just his attitude.
King Haggard himself is the main villain of the story, unless I guess you count the Red Bull, but it's not really a character. King Haggard is the king of all unhappiness. He cannot be happy. Anything he does to try and make himself happy, he eventually gets bored of. He's incapable of actually being content or finding the value in anything.
Yes, he's a really interesting character because this story, going on to actually relate to what I said earlier about it not being complicated, it not having politics and all that, it doesn't actually go deep into lore. You know, this is very much the fairy tale kingdom. We're not diving on its history, and it's certainly no maps abound. All we get is that this king, King Haggard, came across the sea, got a witch to build his castle, and sort of just set up camp. We don't get his background. All we learn about him is that the Red Bull, the magical creature that serves him because he has no fear. I think that's the line he gives. And that's it. And that it will do whatever he wants it to do to make him happy, whatever his desire is.
Oh, I finally understand something about the ending. Yeah. Yes, right. And
what do you do with that?
Yeah, I got a little click there because something in us was like,
I'm glad a little click happens,
but it doesn't. I'm not really sure, but now I know for certain. Okay, so King Haggard is the villain because he has gotten Red Bull to get rid of all the unicorns. We don't know why. It takes a long time for this to be like unpacked and made clear. And the reason why it happens is that he wanted the unicorns. He wanted to collect them because he thought it might make him happy. And it did for a little while. And the Red Bull herded all the unicorns into the sea. And they're still there, invisible to everyone except him, thrashing around, trying to get back to shore, but too afraid of the Red Bull to actually approach. So they're stuck there, immortal, forever.
What a fate. The magic around the Red Bull is it's very loose, it's very soft. And I'll be honest with you, Geordie, I was wrapping my head...
It's not clear what the bull is itself.
No, I was going left and right on this, trying to work out what the larger metaphor was meant to be. I'm like, okay, there's clearly... There must be something here, but I can't quite... I'm like, the Red Bull is described as... Well, it's terrifying, and it's all powerful, and everyone across the land talks about it. But it doesn't have its own wants. Its wants are only what Haggard wants. It serves the person with no fear. But also, really interesting, if you get near the climax, the Red Bull doesn't really fight either. It's all about fear and bluster.
No.
It conquers. It does not fight.
It's like a sheepdog. It herds. Yes, conquer is a word that it uses. That's right.
And I was literally saying that, like, what does it mean? And I'm really sorry, because obviously if you're listening to this podcast, you might be hoping that I'm going to give you some depth into the text, and you'll be like, oh, thank you, Duncan, for expanding on it. And I'm literally sat here like, I don't know what it means. I don't quite sure. It's human condition.
I had to assume that it was sort of like a desire to control, a desire to take things selfishly. Like, it's a sort of manifestation of King Haggard's greed, but he wants to keep these unicorns, and it's uncompromising. So, yeah, in my view, in the same way that, like, the unicorns represent all that is good, this Red Bull is their opposite. It represents all that is wicked and evil. When I was watching a music video for the last unicorn song, my partner walked up behind me, looked over my shoulder, pointed at the Red Bull and said, "What is that thing?" And me, having not finished a book yet, shrugged and said, "I don't know, Satan maybe?"
I mean, fair. I think there's definitely an element there that links the Red Bull back to the fact that it serves Haggard because Haggard has no fear. So its only control is fear. It's not an actual threat. I couldn't quite pin that into the real world. But I think it's a nice motif for a villain anyway. That, you know, the only thing to fear is fear itself. Oh, it's very Dune, actually. I see where we're going now. And
Okay.
Overcoming the... I'm jumping way too near the end, so we've got to roll back because there are other points I want to hit on before I get to this next bit.
Exactly. So, and I think to do that, we need to talk about Prince Lear. So King Haggard is his father. Prince Lear is this boy who is raised by Haggard in his castle, and who is extremely important in the latter part of the book in terms of getting the unicorn to complete her arc. I guess really what we need to say is right before they get to Haggate is they are confronted by the Red Bull. It shows up and it chases down the unicorn in a very beautiful scene. It's incredibly well written. And Molly begs Schmendrick to save the unicorn somehow, to use his magic. And for the first time, he actually manages to come into his own and he casts a spell to to change the unicorn. And there's this great thing in this book, this great theme which says, like, how, like, crazy it is to actually change something, to change something's nature, and how one thing, after it's been changed, can't possess the same attributes that it used to. He changes the unicorn from being a unicorn into being a woman, Amalthea, Lady Amalthea. And the unicorn is gutted by this, even though it saves her from the Red Bull. It can't chase her anymore because it's looking for a unicorn, not a woman. And she's outraged by this because previously she was perfect. She was the best thing in the world, and now she's some lady. Yes, very beautiful, but not as beautiful as a unicorn.
Yes, and the kind of implication here, there is actually a backstory. This is foreshadowed in the book. Svenjik tells the unicorn a story of his master Nikos doing a similar thing, and the talks of, you know, you can't go back once you have no knife, not as a unicorn. So we get set up for how devastating this is going to be, but it's also the part where the unicorn really starts their arc. She then now has this moment to, like, okay, I've almost looked down on humans for not being as perfect as me. Now I am one. Now I've got to slowly learn to relate and appreciate humanity a tad more, bit by bit.
Well, not quite, because what it kind of sounds like you're saying is a much less nuanced story. That would be something like, there are plenty of movies that are made about, like, angels who turn into human beings and learn to appreciate life as a lesser being. This isn't
Actually, Jordy, can I just stop you there and say what this
Pinocchio
actually... This is
a story.
That would be... You say about movies about angels. No, this is any film where some, like, rich person ends up slumming it a bit and then discovers, oh, it's actually quite nice down on the working classes. Like, Titanic style.
Sure.
Like, that would be what that would be. Can't stand it, don't like it. Anyway, but it's not that. It is better.
I hear what you're saying. Yes. But the more significant thing is that once you're a human, you aren't a unicorn anymore. And you start to lose the things about you that make you a unicorn. So when she's first transformed, she still has, like, some of her magical powers, but not all of them, and she loses the ones she does have. But she also loses her memories of being a unicorn. She slowly forgets. And once you've forgotten something, well, you aren't that thing anymore. So at a certain point, she is just a human, and a quite confused one at that.
I think there's a small section where she even talks about, you know, better to have died as a perfect unicorn, and then at least I would have existed, you know, forever. As that.
Untainted. Yeah.
Oh, God, how dare she be tainted?
The gold star unicorn.
Now she's tainted by humanity. But this then leads us on to the latter third of the book. I love something. We've really jumped over the little questing episodes. They're all quite good. There's a harpy, a tree that falls in love with a man, and some Robin Hood bits. But this is where the real heart is.
Yeah, I liked the zoo at the beginning. That was interesting. But yes, I have deliberately stepped over those because they're not going to actually enrich our discussion of what the book is like or about. They're fun adventures and they're likable enough, but it's not what the book's about.
No. And they're only really, as we talk about the little episodes, they're only actually there to introduce the relevant characters fundamentally to the story.
Yeah, it's like Journey to the West. They introduce the different members of the gang.
So we get to Hagrid's castle and we meet Prince Lear and Hagrid. And I really like this first initial interaction, because talking about the comedy side of things, this is actually the only bit that maybe kind of did get a chuckle out of me, is that we meet the two guards out front doing a little routine. Who's that? What are you doing here? Gosh, isn't she beautiful? We want to meet the king. Fine, I'll take you to the king. And these two guards march off. There's an older one and a younger one. And then they throw the doors open to the disheveled throne room. And Smendrick's like, the king wouldn't possibly be here. And then the old guard just turns around and goes, I am King Hagrid. I'm too cheap to pay for another guard.
It is a good bit, actually. I like that. But yeah, and Prince Lear, his introduction to the unicorn is not as the unicorn. It says Lady Amalfia, her human alter ego. And he falls in love with her at first sight because, again, this is a fairy tale. And very explicitly, this is actually brought up later, which is that the reason why he's fallen in love with her so hard, so fast, is that he's lived his whole life in King Haggard's castle. Which sucks. Like, there's nothing nice there. He doesn't have anything to make him happy. There's nothing there for him to enjoy or people for him to meet. So when he sees this incredibly beautiful woman, he says, "It's like I was brought to life for the first time."
Now, this is a bit of an interesting moment, though, Geordie, because the character of Prince Lear is actually introduced earlier on to have already been engaged.
That was so... Yeah... That bit...
It's a little detail. It's like, you're not meant to think about it, but it is one of those ones where you went, that was a curious bit to be slot in there, because that does fly slightly in the face of what we're chatting about. But, and then my brain...
It does feel a teeny bit first drafty that, you know, like, Prince Lear did show up earlier, and then, like, kind of teleports into a different part of the book.
I'm just like, that connection. So we meet Prince Lear, not knowing it's him, with another woman earlier on in the book, in one of these little episodes. But it's just the prince in that scene. And then later he's like, I was the prince from that scene, and I've broken my engagement off with that woman you saw me with. I'm like, you didn't have to be related. I don't think it adds to the point. And brings up way too many questions about Hagrid's attempts at politics in this kingdom. And we don't need. But anyway.
Also, you were reading a magazine. What the fuck?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Oh, too many questions.
What year is it?
Prince Lear has a magazine.
It's the classic, like, once in future king shit, where it's like, that's a version of King Arthur where, like, people go to Eton. It's like, don't think about it. Don't think about it. Does this exist in a time and place? No, shut up.
But we get this lovely scene. And I'm not going to lie to you, I actually thought, just going back to that little comedy bit at the start, I know it's meant to be how awful Hagrid is and, like, you know, how downtrodden they all are in his castle. I did, a bit of me, think it almost came across as kind of sweet that he literally spent his days standing guard with his son. It was a little cute.
Yeah, but it wasn't wholesome father-son bonding activity. He's just too cheap.
Quite right, quite right. As we learn later, there are but four men-at-arms in this castle. And until Molly came, no other servants.
Just enough to think, maybe you'll think there's actually an army there.
Again, lovely tie-in. It's not about actually having any power. It's the fear of it. Good little linking with the Red Bull there. But yes, they come here.
Oh, Duncan, you're on fire today.
I know, my very best. So they come to the castle and Smendrick spins his tail. Again, actually, I think one of the more funny scenes where Smendrick convinces Hagrid to take him on as his court magician and fire the other bloke who has a proper tantrum about it.
Yeah, he shows up and says, listen, I'm not a very good wizard, and you have a much better one on staff now, but you should fire him and hire me because you have a really competent magician and he hasn't made you happy, so maybe I will.
Just incredible logic. Just like that bit, we're talking about like telepracticisms. That was a little bit of telepracticism of like,
oh yeah, fluctuating logic. Douglas Adams. That's something that Ford Prefect would say.
Yes, you're right. Writing with hitchhikers. I should try that in a job interview. So why should we hire you? You know nothing. And previously you've hired people who knew something. Did they get the job done? Right. So that's like, and he accepts. And they come into the castle. And what plays out next is actually meant to be over quite a time span. I think there's a number of months. They're in sort of wintering in this castle.
Oh, yeah. It's a long period of time. There's like three separate time skips. Because there's a period of time where Prince Lear is trying to, like, woo the Lady Amalthea. And he does this by doing all the stuff you'd expect from a prince in fairy tales. He's like saying, I've brought her three separate dragon heads and she still doesn't return my affections.
Prince Lear, I think this character could so very easily come across as arrogant and unlikable and too presumptuous.
Exactly. It's start off, I'm like, I'm so wary of this guy because I think he's going to be a total tool. And I'm so surprised I come round on him really fast. And I think it's just because he's a kind of awkward himbo.
I think it what they do really well is that they establish that, I say it's not his fault, he has been effectively indoctrinated into the one way of doing things. He sat there and he's like, this is the only, he like laments to Molly, he's like, I know no other ways. This is the only way people have ever told me I can woo a woman. I'm a hero. This is what I do. And so that's that kind of...
And when Molly says, maybe you should try writing some poetry, he's like, yeah, I'll do that right now. And then he immediately starts writing extremely bad poetry.
And then that makes him more endearing, the fact that he's open to new ideas. I think that's the crux, I think, which keeps him on the right side. That since he, like, has a best song, goes with a different idea, he's like, sure, I'll give that a go.
And it's not like I'm ever like, hell yeah, Prince Lear and the unicorn should get together. But I do think it's sweet in the end how it goes, you know?
I do too. And finally, we've caught up to that moment when we were chatting about the Red Bull earlier. And I was like, okay, we've got to back up. We've got to back up here. It gets really sweet because I think what we see here is the almost what could have been as the unicorn becomes more human. And I like the fact that they never really... They talk about them like falling in love. And Leo is very much in love with the unicorn or Lady Amalthea. Mm-hmm. I like that. I don't think it's made clear that they like don't even ever really touch. Like hold hands.
No. They explicitly don't, I think. Like even at the very end, like as they're facing the Red Bull, Schmendrick like looks to them to hold hands and they don't. And I think that's partly because, like, it's like the unicorn's magic. She's holding back, even though she doesn't know why, because she expects her powers to have great consequence, and she's sort of afraid of the fact she doesn't have that power anymore.
Oh, see, no, I interpreted it as it's the human response. Like, if you're two people and, you know, you're scared, you reach out to each other. So it's the fact that it's that little bit of her true nature of being a unicorn that means she doesn't reach out to another. Unicorns have established as being solitary creatures in this world. It's not in her nature to reach out to someone.
And we should make clear that it's like it's instinct at this point, because at this point Amalthea has no memory of being a human. She's been a human for pretty much many months, like seasons change in the meantime. She has no actual memory. She dreams of being a unicorn and she doesn't know what she's dreaming about, and these dreams frighten her. And that's actually part of what like draws her to Lear, is like some sense of safety with him that would protect her from her own dreams. Eventually though, King Haggard figures out, or has always known, that she was a unicorn, and they manage to crack the riddle of how to get to his secret underground lair, where he keeps the Red Bull, which keeps the unicorns captive. And I do like the scene where they like manage to crack the riddle by like sort of like bending the rules a little bit of the way things. Like, do you remember what the riddle is itself?
All I remember is that I love a talking cat, and I love the fact Molly goes, "Can you all talk?" And they're just like, "When we feel like it." Again, great. Honestly, I think actually the comedy actually really ticks up in like Hagrid's castle.
I think you're right. I think it's because there isn't a lot of like adventure going on. They get to just sort of sit around and chat. And it also just gets to be like Schmendrick just gets a lot sadder as a character now that he doesn't have to like do anything. He was important before and now he can't like progress or get better at magic. So he's just sort of bumming around feeling sorry for himself. There's a good bit where they ask him how to spell miracle, how many R's are there, and he says two. It's from the same root as mirror.
Oh, it's really interesting. This book really has some very, that feel very distinct sections. Like, I do actually have to say that the way the book is written and paced just feels very different at the point. I do feel like this book was written on a sort of a Tolkien style, it grew in the telling. This might even predate Lord of the Rings. Definitely doesn't predate The Hobbit. Was it in the 50s?
No, it's from the 60s.
60s, okay, fair enough, so it doesn't predate any of that. But that the writing style was still kind of like changing and chopping as we move through. Sorry, but back to the riddle. Yes, the cat and the skull. Lay it upon me, Geordie.
Yes, so... So I like this section because, and I'm afraid I don't remember the exact wording of the riddle, but it's essentially three impossible things need to happen. A wine needs to drink itself, a skull needs to talk, and a clock needs to strike the hour. And these things are impossible because, one, heads don't talk, two, wine can't drink itself, and three, the clock in question is broken and, like, can't be relied upon at all. It sometimes strikes, like, 17 o'clock.
So how do they get around this, Geordie? The talking skull is quite straightforward. They magic a skull to talk.
I think it always could talk. They just had to persuade it to, right?
You're quite right. It's actually been set there to guard the entrance to the Red Bull's cave.
Yeah, they just sort of need to convince it to talk by, like, flattering it or, like, or persuading it or blackmailing it. And then the wine, I didn't get. I just didn't understand how Schmendrick, like, qualified that part of the riddle.
It was an empty wine bottle that he talks to the skull to drink to the memory of what the skull remembered wine used to taste like. And that qualified as drinking itself, I think.
I think that might be right, but I don't understand why that fulfills the qualification. And then they just walked through the clock. The clock just was like...
No, that was another major factor. The fact that the wine seemed unrelated to opening the passageway. You just had to sort of know you could walk through the clock and walk through it. And you'd be magically teleported somewhere.
I guess it was just like a series of quite bad instructions, really, as opposed to like a series of things you had to accomplish. But yes, they walk through the clock and that leads them to the final confrontation. They have to get past the Red Bull. King Haggard is after them. He's been alerted by the skull that they're intruding. And this leads to a really beautiful end to the story. There's a lot of... As beautiful as this book is, the climax and the ending are some of the strongest of any book we've read so far.
I'm very inclined to agree. One thing I did notice is that these last couple of chapters did get significantly longer as the book went on.
That's true.
And not that it's like a bad thing in any way, but I do think this book benefits from such a strong ending. Like, it finishes on such a powerful note, like full on 10 out of 10, that maybe some of the earlier sections, if I'd ranked like 7 or 8 out of 10, don't matter at this point. This is a 10 out of 10 experience.
The full experience of reading a book is so strong that the whole part of it feels elevated.
I'm just saying that, sorry, in comparison quickly, just to the same way though that I might say, like, I love The Hobbit. The Hobbit's one of my favourite books of all time. But with The Hobbit, I wouldn't say that the ending is the clincher that brings it all together. I actually often think it's a little bit of a dull letdown. Once the dragon's dealt with, I find the books, you know, you got to get to the end. It's the little episodes that just make it. The trolls, Riddles in the Dark, those are the high points. Whereas this is very much not that case.
Where they bit the end of The Hobbit where he goes back home with Gandalf and Bjorn for a certain part of the way, and they say, and his journey home was not without event. The Wild was still the Wild, but obviously it was so unimportant and uninteresting to Tolkien himself that he's just like, move over that.
Great ending in its own way, but not the same as this one. So we finally caught back up to what I was talking about earlier. What's something I really like? So we're descending, just to set the scene, people. The castle is on the bluffs above the sea. Sort of high up on the battlements, King Haggard looks on, watching the waves and the unicorns trapped there. We're going down a cave system inside the cliff to presumably the Red Bull's lair that will then lead out of a big cave onto the beach and then to the sea itself. Okay, so that's the setup. And if we go down the cave, we get so much of the thought process. We get that Lady Amalia...
Amalthea.
Oh my gosh. Amalthea is leading the way.
Like Amalthea.
Amalgamthea. Excellent. That's a planet in Hitchhikers. So, leading the way. Everyone's following her just by the glow of her. And I really enjoy the fact that there's a bit where Smendrick is surprised because he thought at this point, they're debating. They're like, what are we going to do? Because we could be facing the Red Bull. And Smedjic's like, and I'll turn her back into a unicorn and she'll kill the bull and free the unicorns and that will be the end of our story. But then there's a bit of him as he looks at Leah and talks to Morneus about, you know, it's all going on, that Leah's in love with her and she is possibly taking a fancy to him, not maybe in a direct way, growing fondness.
No, she's very much in love with him at this point. But she doesn't realize that she shouldn't be. She doesn't remember that she's not a human. So she has all of a human's feelings. She has love and a fear of death and stuff like that.
And in this moment, I love the fact that Smedjic is almost arguing himself. He's like, I know how fairy tales have to go. I know that the first, like, these two can't be together because we have to save the unicorns. And there's this really cool bit where he goes, well, I don't know. Actually, maybe if they sneak off and live happily ever after together, just the two of them, and we forget about the unicorns, maybe they'll be happy. Maybe that's an ending in itself. It's not a bad ending. Maybe we'll go for that ending. At no point do I think this is actually like a meta commentary. I don't think Peter Beagle ever thought that that would be his ending. He knows where he's going, but I love that he really plays with the audience because I'm there like, yeah, I actually don't know how I would feel about that. What ending do I want? Do I get to pick? Is this an ice cream counter?
Exactly, yeah. There's something great about the fact that it's acknowledging right from the start, like, there isn't really a happy way to end this. You can't get everything you want. No one is going to be totally happy at the end of this story, even after the villain is defeated. And the sad part begins when they unexpectedly run into the Red Bull too early.
Yes, the Red Bull, and this is where we really hand over to the more poetic descriptions, because the Red Bull has snuck up the passageway towards them. But I love how it's described that it's almost become one with the rock. Like, it both fills the whole space, yet isn't physically filling the whole space. There is something kind of ethereal about the description of the Red Bull, similar to how the unicorns describe.
Absolutely. The Red Bull is like fire. It fills the space it's in, and it becomes as immense as it needs to be. Like, at a certain point, it's described as being, like, so large that you couldn't possibly miss it, and yet it's gone.
It's very much then leads into that metaphor of the Red Bull is fear. It is whatever it needs to be for you to be scared of it.
Because even though it's like so large that like it fills the entire passageway, like when people throw themselves aside to get away from it, they don't get hit by it.
A really...
Like if they're trying to avoid it and hide from it, it can't really like touch them.
This goes on to several points. I love the fact that I think it's Smedjic who's almost wondering. He's like, it should have just killed us all there. But it didn't, you know, but it scattered them. They're alone, they're isolated, they've all jumped in different directions. And it sort of then feeds into that element, you know, it definitely can hurt you physically. But it's not in its nature to. Its nature is to scare you.
That's right, it says it's to scare you to conquer, not to kill. And so, catch me, because I listened to this in an audiobook, I think I literally missed the exact second this happens, Duncan. But Smedjic works one more great feat of magic and he turns the Lady Amalthea back into the unicorn, right?
There is a moment before that that is really important where Lady Amalthea, as she gets thrown to the side, she's injured. Leah's weapons, as he takes them out to face down the Red Bull, they turn scorching hot in his hands and he drops them and they shatter like ice. Yet in that moment,
yes,
Leah
right.
still takes his stand, holding his hands up as if he still was holding his sword and shield, and faces down the bull. There's a funny bit where it's like he sticks his tongue in the side of his mouth and almost looked like a small child. But it's Smedjic sees him conquering his fear. And that's the important point that Smedjic realises about his magic. And there's a lovely description where we get, you know, told about the future. Smedjic would go on and his name would be greater than all of his masters before him. And every time he would cast great magic, mm-hmm. he would picture Leah standing there, looking a bit foolish, conquering his fear. And that's what unlocks the power within him.
And that starts off the great end theme of the story, which is that the bull represents fear, so it has to be conquered by courage. And Lear has the courage to face it, even though he has no power to stop it. And what has to happen is the unicorn needs to find that same courage. She and every other unicorn up to that point has run away when confronted by the bull. So somehow she needs to find the courage to face it. So Shmendrick casts one more great feat of magic. He transforms the Lady Amalthea back into the unicorn. The Red Bull starts to chase the unicorn again because that's what he's like programmed to do. And because she keeps running from it, the bull has power over her. And Lear, this is such a beautiful moment. Lear demands, he's finally found out that his girlfriend is a unicorn. He doesn't seem too put out by this. He wants the unicorn to be saved, and he demands that Shmendrick save her. Shmendrick says he can't. And then Lear says, "Then what is magic for?" Lear demanded wildly. "What use is wizardry if it cannot save a unicorn?" He gripped the magician's shoulder hard to keep from falling. Shmendrick did not turn his head. With a touch of sad mockery in his voice, he said, "That's what heroes are for."
Go on, Peter. Solid line there. Just hits you right in the chest.
So what happens is, guided by these words, Lear throws himself before the bull, in between it and the unicorn, and is trampled to death. Every time they try to avoid the bull, it doesn't touch them because it wants them to be afraid. Trying to meet it one-on-one, like to actually touch it, it is tangible and it crushes Lear. And the unicorn, who previously ran in fear because she can die from violence, but now who has been a human, and has memories of being a human, and has memories of human love, and an understanding of human loss. She's heartbroken by Lear's death, and she is guided to confront the Red Bull, to square down against it, and to stand her ground.
And what we get here is a really interesting decision that I absolutely adore, because we don't get the unicorn lowering her head and charging the Red Bull and smiting it down. What we get is the Red Bull turning and running.
Exactly.
This is, again, goes back. She has conquered her fear through her love, through her, we're not going, almost rage at this point, at seeing his death and appreciation to what death is. And I love the fact that the Red Bull turns, it runs. It is no longer a threat, and eventually she drives the Red Bull itself into the sea.
And it's such a beautiful ending. And that frees the other unicorn to come rushing onto the land, and it's this triumphant moment, but she doesn't immediately join them.
No, we get this lovely, almost quiet moment. So first we get this big torrent. The unicorns are rushing out of the ocean. To those that can't truly perceive them, there it's like the waves are coming over the land. Smedjik and Molly huddle down by Lear's body. Smedjik, I think, works a little bit of magic to stop them getting actually physically trampled to death. They overflow the castle. They wash it away like the tide washes away a sandcastle. There's a lovely paragraph earlier on, by the way, where Molly observes the whole event as if it is just like kids playing on the beach with two dolls, a ivory unicorn toy and a little sandcastle with a little king on top, which I thought was very cute and a wonderful paragraph that didn't need to be there but did so much. But after the tide has washed over, we're sitting there next to Lear's trampled body, which, by the way, I'm not gonna lie, it's actually quite brutally trampled. I think we get quite a good description of this. His head is like half bashed into
this. Do we? I don't remember that.
Yeah, well, it's not gory by any extent. Again, there's definitely a bit about a leg twitching, which I thought was like, oh, extra step.
Oof, okay, fair enough.
And the unicorn comes forward, and the unicorn's magic is to power over things, and in this moment she has power even over death. Oh, that's actually not the lines, it's actually much better than that. not in power over things, power to deny things, power to, anyway, brings Leah back to life. And they look at each other, and she touches him again, and then she goes.
The unicorn can speak, but she doesn't speak to them at this point.
And they're all just kind of left standing there. There's this really nice bit where they kind of look out to the sea, expecting to see the ball. And they're like, he's disappeared. He shouldn't have. He's too big to have disappeared this quickly. Did he sink to the depths? Or what has happened? And it almost does go a little bit back to Haggard's intro. Like, Haggard came from over the sea. Is there something beyond the horizon? But again, not gone into, not relevant to this story.
No, it's not. And what happens now is that they're left to sort of pick up the pieces of their story. Like, Lear is king now. He's King Lear. The people of Haggate are like, hey, can you fix things and not end a curse? And Lear says, no, you profited from my father and the curse that was put upon him, or put upon you to be fortunate whilst he was thinking. I suggest now you have children. You know, you get on with life. You accept that life is hard and it's going to be hard for you. Deal with it. And so what's happened here is that the characters are reckoning with the end of their story. They're asking themselves what comes next. And Lear is the great question, because Lear has loved a unicorn. And he wants to find the unicorn. And he says, like, to Schmendrick, if I could just chase her, to know that I was following after her, I would be happy just to know that. And Schmendrick has to sort of take him back to reality and say, no, you must follow your duty. That's not the end of your fairy tale. You're the hero. The prince has become king. That's the end of the story. And Lear has to accept that which cannot be. Much like the unicorn, he deals with human feelings of regret and loss. But as they're going through the kingdom, the three of them, they have one last meeting with the unicorn. And, Duncan, you can feel this bit because it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's... So the unicorn comes to all three of them, but comes to them separately, almost, well, in their dreams. And they each get their own individual sort of interaction. But what's really lovely, so beautiful about the writing, is that we actually only see through Smendrick as a POV. So we get his talk with the unicorn, what we discussed earlier about his thoughts on magic and what's important. And in some respects, I think there's an element to, you know, you show that Smendrick has come to a greater understanding about the unicorn and about himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's also no longer immortal at this point. That happened earlier when he turned the unicorn back. Great scene about the immortality falling from him. I don't know. It's something along the lines of either as a weight or as armor. As in, that's the line. It's like, fell from him like armor, or was it, or as a weight, or something to that effect, or veil, something to that tune. Anyway, he has this great scene with this nice interaction. And what I really enjoy isn't actually Smendrick's one. That's not the one that I think is the most beautiful. Is that when he wakes, he realizes that everyone else has had these dreams. And Leah has this just heartfelt, did you see her? Did you see her? And they're like, yeah, no, we had a chat. And he's like, she didn't say anything to me. She just looked at me. And I don't know, it's something I find really powerful about that. I also love that Smendrick lies. He's like, what did you chat about? And Smendrick's just like, oh, you know, the little things, this and that, the weather.
I know, it's so sweet. But the best part is that they say to Molly, what does she say to you? And she says, no, I will keep that conversation, that secret, close to my heart. It is mine alone to treasure.
And as a reader, we'd never know.
We don't. Schmendrick asks her about it later and says, like, you told me, right? And she says, nope.
But Leah actually does get one kind of bit of consolation in all of this, in that, you know, he's heartbroken. He doesn't want to go back and just be a good king. And I really like there's two kind of elements here that are really nicely done. The first one, I like that there's a talk about, you know, the land will be as good as the people that inhabit it. This goes back to Haggate. You know, if they can find happiness and joy in, you know, the orchard that they enjoy just for the growing of it is the one that will grow the most beautiful and they'll appreciate the most. Again, going back to the inner beauty, outer beauty, tell the story, you know, Haggard was evil through and through. Also, I love the fact that Smenjit goes, the unicorn touched you twice when he brought you back to life. And it's like, yes. And he's like, she only had to do that once to bring you back to life. The second touch was only for you. Ah, heart melt again.
Looks so beautiful. Oh my God.
Beautiful scene. And then Leah gets on his horse, rides away. And I actually really enjoy that Smenjit and Molly, who have had a very interesting relationship throughout most of the book, because it's all pivoting off the unicorn, by and large.
Right. She's the focal point of their connection.
Yeah, there's not actually anything that ties them, but I love that it's basically unspoken that they're like, we're going to head off together. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah? Heading the same way?
Yeah.
And then we get the last little beautiful moment, which, again, I suppose leans... I'm going to call it telepathicism. I know this predates him, like, by 20 years.
But it's what it feels like.
It's what it feels like, because that's where my origins lie. A princess runs up to them and is like, oh, bequeath thee. My good lord king has been betrayed by his villainous uncle, the Varan Wolfblood, and goes on about, my good brothers are entrapped, I need help. And Smidge is just like, yeah, the guy you need is that way. Take my horse, you'll catch up with him soon. Go and enjoy your story.
But it's great. It's great because, and this is the difference, is that, and this is not a dig at Pratchett, because we both love Terry Pratchett, and his books are very heartwarming. But what I don't think would happen in a Terry Pratchett book is that the character, like, you can imagine Rincewind or Sam Vimes doing the exact same thing, which is say, you're talking to the wrong guy, the guy you're looking for, the hero, is that way. What I don't think would happen next is Smenjit getting off his horse, giving it to her, and having to walk the rest of the way by himself. But then just, like, tipping back his head and laughing at it. And laughing for a long time. Laughing about the fact that... About the twist of fate, and about the completion of the story, but also about the place he's in his life. And how he's been changed, and the hope he has for the future. You know, it's this beautiful, sweet moment to end the story with.
And it is a beautiful and sweet story through and through. Jordy, I really like this book.
I like it too, man. I really like this book.
It definitely holds a place. It holds a very interesting place, Jordy, where I, throughout the start, I was saying, you know, we've mentioned Terry Pratchett quite a lot throughout this, and I've mentioned The Hobbit, and I mentioned House Moving Castle, and there's an element of The Wizards of Earthsea.
It's closest to House Moving Castle of all the ones you've mentioned.
I think you're probably right.
Not that we've done that one yet. We have a plan for that episode.
So if you like any of the above, which is an awful lot, I would recommend The Last Unicorn to you, full-heartedly.
I would strongly recommend it too. Maybe the movie? I can't say. We haven't seen it. I like the song.
Yeah, the animation looks, you know, it's not... Or is it Ghibli?
It's almost Ghibli. It doesn't look like it, but, you know.
We haven't talked about that much about the Robin Hood's in this, and that would imply this is set some point post-Robin Hood era England.
It's 10... Let's see, 1100s.
Yes. Time of the First Crusade. No, it's not. Third Crusade. I don't know the number of Crusades. King John.
I feel like I've said all I mean to of this book. I really hope that people do read this. I know it's commonly read. Like, I've read an article this morning about the rights issues with Peter Spiegel, who managed to get them back from his, like, agent or whatever. It's a sad story, really. But anyway, and, like, people, it sells like 20,000 copies a year, which is a lot. It has never been out of print. A book written in 1968. That's pretty impressive.
Weirdly, though, it has been quite elusive in my life.
You know, books that have been out of print since the 1960s, The Lord of the Rings. The Lord of the Rings has been out of date in that same span of time. Not out of date, out of print.
Wow, I did not know that fact.
That's kind of cheeky on my part, because it had a really shaky launch in America. So there was a period of time where, okay, this got brought up on our Conan episode, which people should listen to because Duncan did a really good job on it. and I did an okay job bringing it down from like probably close to two straight hours of talking about Conan history. But we mentioned in it that like the Lord of the Rings launch in America was super shaky. They only sold just over 3,000 copies because that's how many they printed, and then they just didn't print more, which led to a period of time where people were selling basically bootlegs of the Lord of the Rings in America, and none of that money went to the Tolkien estate.
Well, that's awful. It's short, isn't it? But don't. I went to a museum once that was displaying like the original American release covers, and you're like, did this artist even get a plot synopsis? So that's not the focus, but I do think maybe that does highlight something, Geordie. Maybe this is something that on the other side of the pond and our American listeners, probably maybe this is just a little bit more widely read, because I feel like I had to dig for this. So maybe the recommendation goes out to more.
I think it is well read, but it's not exactly commonplace. Like, people don't talk about this on r/fantasy, you know.
Well, let's try and turn that trend around, because this is a fantastic book. And if you like any of those other fantasies mentioned, you owe it to yourself to read this. This will bring a level of both maturity and emotional nuance to what seems on the surface such a fairy tale story. But what you'll probably enjoy the absolute most is the fact that it is written in such a beautiful way and will give time to moments.
True.
And the only person I can think who might not enjoy this, if you're someone who, and it is a very much a taste thing, if you enjoy more direct, simple prose, get to the action, let's get moving.
This is not for people who like...
That's not this.
Whose favourite novel is Red Storm Rising. You know, if you're a Tom Clancy fan and you want to get into reading fantasy, this is not the one to go for. Read Promise of Blood, that's more your speed. But no, if you like fantasy... For the love of God, read this book.
And as someone who loves fantasy, Geordie, what are we going to be reading next time?
Whose choice was this?
I'm going to hand it over to you to pick the next book.
Yeah, I picked Priory. So technically, we never did. Yes, this was your choice. We just had to do it, like, in a Facebook Messenger chat instead of doing it. Duncan, I haven't picked the next book. I forgot I had to. You know what? Fuck it. Let's do The Heroes.
Beautiful.
I've been meaning to read it. I don't have anything else planned for us to do at this point. I thought we were going to enjoy Priory, and I was wrong. So I really am a bit lost. I'm pretty confident we'll enjoy The Heroes. I mean, I know you will.
I have already.
This is The Heroes by Jay Abercrombie. Wait, that right? What did I just say?
Yeah, Joe Abercrombie.
Joe Abercrombie, yeah.
Jay Abercrombie, it's not incorrect.
I said it a bit wrong and I got so confused. That's right, The Heroes by Jay Abercrombie, the follow-up to Best Served Cold.
Loosely.
I'm really interested in reading this. I got it at Christmas. It's been sat on my shelf this whole time. I think it's going to slap.
I will not give you any spoilers on how much this will slap. Oh, it will slap, though. It's just how hard will it slap. It's an excellent book. It is the fifth in the First Law series by Joe Abercrombie. It is technically a standalone, so do feel free to just jump in with it. Probably less of a standalone than the last one, Best Served Cold, but that is something to experience along with us next time. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode and have read The Last Unicorn, please tell us your thoughts. Tell us how you read it, when you read it, what influence it had, what books you recommend that are like it. Let us know. I would love to.
That's a great question.
Read more like this. Best places. It's just fantasy podcast on Instagram, or you can email us. It's just fantasy podcast@gmail.com. Love to hear with you. Please rate, review, thumbs up, whatever it is. This episode on whatever platform you are. Leave us a review, even if your review is just two words. Always appreciated.
Yeah, good pod.
Till next time, Geordie.
Till next time. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.
Oh, and one more thing before we go. I promised Duncan I would try to learn the theme to The Last Unicorn on guitar for this episode. So I did my best. I'm a pretty novice guitarist, but hey, this is what I got. Thanks for listening. So long, for real this time.
the last eagle flies over the last crumbling mountain, and the last lion roars at the last dusty fountain. In the shadow of a forest, though she may be old and worn, they will stare unbelieving at the last unicorn. When the first breath of winter through the flowers is icing, and you look to the north, and a pale moon is rising, and it seems the call is dying, and would leave the world to mourn. In the distance, hear the laughter of the last unicorn. I'm alive, I'm alive. When the last moon is cast over the last star of morning, and the future has passed without even a last desperate warning, then look into the sky where through a cloud's path is torn. You can see her, how she sparkles. It's the last unicorn.